Hello and welcome to the BBC Music Magazine podcast. I'm Michael Beek, and this episode we are asking the question, how do you write a film score? And who better to ask than an Academy Award winning film composer? I'm delighted that Anne Dudley is sitting with me. Hello, Anne.
Hello.
Tell me, what is, that's a big question, what is the purpose of music in a film for anyone who just really doesn't get it?
Well, if you've ever seen a film which doesn't have any music, you'd be probably quite well placed to understand what the music does, because it can be quite a tough watch, a film without any music. But a film with good music, whether it's songs or score or a mixture of both, the music can really help take you through the journey of the film. It can take the journey of the drama with the characters and really draw the audience in. So, I mean, as soon as film was invented, people started putting music to him. If you think of silent films and pianists, and soon little orchestras would appear. So I think it's a vital part of film.
It really is. Tell us a little bit about how you start a film score. I'm wondering, it's probably relatively different depending on the project. What is the starting point traditionally for you?
I like to watch the film. Sometimes people send me a script, which is very well, and I'll read the script. But I like to actually see what it looks like. I want to see what the production design looks like. I want to get an idea of the pacing of the editing. I want to see how the actors have interpreted the script. So it's a very much a visual stimulus that I'll get from watching the film the first time. And then, having seen it maybe a couple of times, I'll start to devise a sort of sound palette to it. Is it going to be a big orchestral thing? Is it going to be very intimate, maybe just one or two instruments? What does the film lend itself to? I mean, there are, let's be honest, there are also budgetary issues to consider. I mean, you can't really think of doing a 80-piece orchestra with a very tiny budget. But usually something will occur to me, a sound world, if you like. And by this time, the director may well have their own ideas of what they want the score to sound like as well. Because what often happens is during the process of editing, the director and the editor will put on a temp score. So this is literally a temporary score where they'll get music from anywhere. It could be Hans Zimmer or Shostakovich or Mozart or anything. And they'll start to put that with the pictures and see what that does to it. Now, this can be a curse or it can be a blessing, because it might give you some indication of the direction to go, but it might lead you off in the wrong direction, or it might be so brilliant that you think, oh, for goodness sake, I can't do anything as good as that. It can be quite a thing, a temp score, but it can be an interesting starting point, at least.
I imagine a director might get a bit attached to a temp score and want you to kind of stick very closely to it. Is that part of the problem as well? Do you have to sometimes veer them away from it?
That can be part of the problem. You know, there's that terrible moment when you're playing through your demos to the director and he or she says, oh, what did we have on the temp there? And, you know, you're quite right. If they've sat in the cutting rooms for 6 months hearing the same piece of music to the same bit of film, then trying to get that out of their heads and trying to persuade them that, you know, something else will work equally well, if not better, there can be a trial sometimes. I mean, sensible directors know that a temp score is what it says, temporary.
And how much, I mean, it's probably changed, I imagine, over the years, but I'm imagining directors, producers, whoever, expect quite a lot from you early on in terms of what you deliver and how it's going to sound. They want to hear almost immediately what it will sound like, whereas maybe 10 plus years ago, it might have just been a piano they might have heard, whereas now you might be having to give them, you know, almost a fully fleshed out sound on a computer, perhaps.
Yes, that's certainly true. I mean, when I started, I would literally sit with the director and play something on the piano and say, well, this will be a French horn and this will be an oboe. And you had to rely on somebody's imagination and experience to know that a piano score translated into an orchestral score is not quite the same thing. Nowadays, you're quite right, people expect to hear a pretty good mock-up or demo, if you like, of the original, of what it's going to sound like, of the orchestration. And it is a bit easier to do nowadays because there are some amazing sample libraries. It's something that I've had to get used to, and I actually enjoy it, actually, because it's a useful thing. You can play your mock-up up against the screen and think, you know, that's really a little bit too big if I use that instrument there, and maybe I should simplify that bit there, maybe I could do a bit more. So I get into quite a lot of detail now, quite early on in the process.
And can directors get then a bit attached to that sound and sort of wonder why you then need to go and record it with real people? Is that a danger? Because it's becoming easier to make music.
I think it's fair to say that even the greatest mock-up is not going to sound as good as real people.
I suppose it helps when the budget's, you know, tight and you have to sort of, you know, make things, flesh things out a bit, does it? I mean, if you've got a few musicians and you have to, can you add layers of then
sort of, you know?
Yes, you can do that. I have done that. I use it as a sort of more of a sort of creative. I've done synth strings and just added a string quartet on top. And it doesn't sound like an orchestra and it doesn't sound like a string quartet. It sounds like something in between. And it's quite an interesting sound. I quite like it, actually.
Going back to sort of that early stages of seeing the film and sort of plotting it, is that first sort of viewing of it, are you looking for a more emotional response before you get into the nitty-gritty of like timings and where things need to go?
Yes, I'm just looking for a broad palette. I might be thinking about thematic things. And then when I sort of start to work through it with the picture, I play the picture literally on a screen. And actually, usually, if it's going to be something orchestral, I'll start working on the piano. Because in my mind, I'm very happy to imagine the French horn and the oboe. So I tend to want to sort of get the essence of the music sorted out on piano. And then the detail of where the cues start, where they end, the timing of them, how they fit the picture, that comes along all in good time.
What does that involve? Because, I mean, I'm somebody who knows, you know, a bit about film music, but even that blows my mind, just the idea of just timing these things, knowing where to come in, knowing how many dots to put on the page.
Well, it's one of those things that the art is to hide the art. I think the music needs to sound completely logical and to have coherence, but it actually very cleverly does the right things at the right time. And that's what I work endlessly on, because I hear scores sometimes where somebody's caught every sync point, but the music's so disjointed and doesn't make any sense that it was pointless. And some people approach a cue by working out where the sync points are and fitting the music to fit the sync points. But I tend not to do that, because the music might start to have a life of its own and the sync points that you thought were important aren't important. So it's something that people ask me about, and I can't actually tell you how I do it, but a lot of experience will come into its own there, you know, how to make 5 bars sound like 4 or 7 bars sound like 8, how to give that sort of thing a logic.
And for uninitiated, a sync point we're talking about here is something, a moment of action perhaps on the screen, or a look, or, you know,
something where you feel there needs to be some indication in the music that something's important, something has changed, or we've cut, there's a cut. Or it's a moment where a character said something very significant and you sort of underline it.
I was going to say, how do you deal with dialogue? Because it sort of gets in the way of music, doesn't it?
Yeah, there can be some films which are very dialogue heavy. Funny enough, I was looking back on some Jeeves and Wooster series that I did because I wanted to make some extracts for something. And there's an awful lot of dialogue, talking all the time, all the way through. And the music just has to very, very carefully and subtly underline sometimes the comedy in the dialogue. without getting in the way and find its way in between all the words.
What a tapestry. And so when you've got what you've written, whether it's, you know, on a screen or for a composer working with pencil and paper, what's the next stage? Are you then passing it to people to start orchestrating? Do you do orchestrations yourself? Or i.e. sort of laying it out for the orchestra then to take on if it's an orchestral score?
Yes, I'm very hands-on, actually. I think the orchestration is so vital that very rarely have I actually sent it out for anybody else to orchestrate, because I like to know all the details of what's going to happen. So I do the orchestration, get the parts printed out, take it all along to the studio. I usually conduct my own scores, so I'm out there with the musicians in the studio. So if there's any questions, and there's always questions, I'm sort of on hand to deal with them straight away. I don't like their idea of there being a sort of chain of command, you know, you ask somebody else, and on it goes. But no, so I like to sort of be very direct and communicative with the musicians.
Yeah.
And then you have it all recorded in the studio. You'll then probably take it somewhere else to do what's known nowadays as either a 5.1 or a 7.1 mix, which is a sort of surround mix, which makes it sound like a film, additional speakers. And then you deliver your music to the dubbing theatre, and there's somebody in charge of the overall mix who will have the music, the dialogue, the sound effects, all on separate tracks. And they're responsible for bringing the whole thing together, making what we then hear in the cinema.
Imagine there's a certain amount of having to sort of, you know, just let go of it, and because it's in somebody else's hands then. How much do you have any kind of interaction with that dubbing session, like what they're doing with your music? Are they going to dial it down and, you know, turn up the volume for an explosion or something?
Well, indeed, yes, that's the stage that really you have to let it go a bit.
Yeah.
What makes it especially difficult to let go is that these mixers often ask for stems. And a stem would be, they would ask you to give them the rhythm section separately, say, right, piano separately, and the brass separate, and the percussion separate. So in theory, they can then do their own mix between all these different elements.
Wow.
But of course, you're also giving them carte blanche to leave out something that I might have thought was essential to a particular cue. And you might think, oh, no, and it worked better without the piano. And you might think, well, actually, the piano was the lead instrument. So that could be a tough one, that one.
Yeah.
I do go to dubs occasionally if I'm free. And they do occasionally listen to me if I say, oh, I don't think that's quite right. I don't think that's... Usually, you know, they've done something weird sometimes. They cut the music off sometimes before it's ended properly, or they'll have put the wrong cue in the wrong place just because they thought it worked better. All sorts of things can happen.
And I imagine this day and age where, you know, sort of editing is so non-linear now. It's not a tape machine being spliced. It's on a computer. So even I'm imagining the edit of a film can change late in the game after we've even recorded a score.
Terrible. It's like trying to shoot a moving target, especially if you've tried to tailor your cues to fit exactly mm-hmm. particular scenes, and then you find, oh, there's another 5 seconds in that scene, or, you know, 6.5 seconds has gone. And yeah, it's tricky.
And that's out of your hands, is it then? That's them then just sort of cutting and pasting and moving bits around.
This is where you can really be helped by a music editor. They can be a very valuable member of your team, because they'll have all these separate elements, all these stems that I was talking about. They can do all sorts of magic and make your cue fit again, changing the speed of it, and, you know, very subtly editing it.
You talked a little bit about having that control and being at the session and conducting. Did any of that change when you started working on Hollywood movies after you won the Oscar? Was there a difference in how you were expected to work when you sort of, you know...
I did work on a couple of films where I had an orchestrator, and it was great because he was brilliant and we got on very, very well. And his input was invaluable. But, you know, I think you have to do things the way that you do them and not change your way of working just before, because most people work in a different way. I was talking to Daniel Pemberton, and I know that he feels the same way. You know, you don't always have to, you don't have to be the Hans Zimmer with the huge 30-piece team around you. There's a role for the people who are rather more individualistic and mavericks, I suppose.
And I guess sort of to end on, where are we at with film music today, do you think? Are you being asked to write in a different way? Are you being asked to write different sort, a different type of music? Is it more sound design these days, do you think, for many composers? Has it changed?
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that. I think there's less emphasis on themes, thematic material now. I do hear film scores with lots of lovely textures and absolutely no melodic content. And I sometimes wonder, did the composer write some melodic content which got sort of excised at some stage? Or is this a deliberate thing that the music is really just part of the sound design? And I think there's also a tendency in films nowadays to have a lot more music. If you were to go back 30 years, you'd find lots of films which really only, you know, you'd have an hour and a half's film and it would only have 20 minutes worth of music in it, or half an hour's worth of music. Now, quite a lot of films seem to have rather continuous soundtracks, and maybe too many melodic and thematic themes going on in that sort of context is too much to take anyway. So, and I think it's evolving, you know, film music's changing all the time.
Wonderful stuff. Well, Anne, thank you so much for sharing that with us. It's been so interesting to talk to you about your craft. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, my thanks to Anne Dudley there, Oscar-winning composer. Always a pleasure to chat to a film composer for me. I'm in the studio now with my colleagues from BBC Music Magazine, Charlotte Smith, Jeremy Pound and Steve Wright. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Let's begin. What is your favourite moment of film music? Is it a score? Is there a moment in a film that you love musically?
I've gone for probably not a hugely well-known film, but one where I found the music completely revelatory. It's from 1991. It's a Krzysztof Kieslowski film called The Double Life of Veronique. The film itself is a haunting kind of meditation on what it might be like to have a doppelganger out there somewhere, another version of you, who you were sort of dimly aware of at times, feeling their same pains, joys, sadnesses. The two women, Veronica in Poland and Veronique in France. When Veronica has a tragic accident hundreds of miles away, Veronique feels it somewhere inside as a kind of ineffable sadness. So it's a storyline full of strangeness somehow and kind of existential exploration. And the music, which is by the Polish composer Zbigniew Preisner, captures that mystery and strangeness absolutely perfectly for me. And I also like the fact that the music even has its own story. In the film, it's supposedly composed by this fictitious 18th century Dutch composer, Van den Boedenmeyer, who crops up in a couple of other films by Kieslowski and Preisner. So there's a feeling he's even being built into the musical heritage somehow. But it's mostly for that atmosphere that I love.
Jeremy?
Yes, mine is also down to the fact that it's a case of conjuring up an atmosphere. In my case, it's Ryuichi Sakamoto's score for Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, which starred, amongst other people, Tom Conte, David Bowie, and in a quite large role for himself, Sakamoto himself actually appears in the film himself. But what he does here is that there's a very hot, claustrophobic atmosphere to the film, which runs through much of it. And it's sort of set in kind of a Japanese prisoner of war camp. He conjures up that feeling brilliantly with his score. You can almost feel the sweat running down you at times. But it's also got moments of extreme beauty. It's not just a kind of ambient sounds. There's some gorgeous tunes in there as well. And a real, he kind of plays on that kind of Far Eastern heritage as well, which creates, it's stunning, stunning score.
Charlotte.
Can I have two?
Yes.
Is that greedy?
I've got 100.
Oh, yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I've got a favourite use of music to uplift or contribute to a film. And I think that for me, that's this very minimalist soundtrack by Kenji Kawai to the 1998 Japanese horror film Ring or Ringu. I don't know if you've ever seen or heard of this film, but there were a sort of spate of these films in the early 2000s where you had these sort of long-haired, pale sort of ghost girls that terrorized people. But this was the first of that. And the film was directed by Hideo Nakata, and it was given a Western remake in 2002 by Gore Verbinski.
I've seen that.
Yeah, but that's not half as effective as the original film because, and I think it's the soundtrack, actually, because the original has this incredibly creepy score. It's full of all these sort of woozy, stomach-clenching slides and high whining harmonics and these deep gongs and kind of heartbeats that you sort of feel rather than hear. And the 2002 soundtrack, which is by Hans Zimmer, and that's much more tuneful and straightforward. And there's nothing wrong with it, but the original is that much more terrifying. I've tried watching it without the soundtrack, and it's not scary at all. It's the soundtrack that gives you all the fear. But my favourite soundtrack of all time is, of course, John Williams' score for E.T., and I'm not ashamed to say it. You know, it's Williams at his most gloriously tuneful, soaring, epic, lush strings, bright winds, muted horns, lots of augmented chords that, you know, give it that uplifting feeling of awe. And, you know, there's no way that that strange rubber puppet that they made into E.T. would have been half as effective without the music. There's no way. So actually, my advice is to listen to the closing credits, because that starts with a solo piano. And I think that's probably how Williams would have played it to Steven Spielberg back in the day when he first played him the score. And I love the idea of him playing it to him like that.
Lovely. And I also love that all of these choices, including your Ring one, are all sort of about atmosphere and creating sort of atmosphere. And in my case, tension, because my favourite film score is Psycho by Bernard Herrmann.
Yes, yes.
Which is just this kind of unrelenting score for only strings. It's only for violins and cellos, actually, the original score. And so it's just this very austere, sort of spare. He uses music very sparely at Herrmann, actually. The cues are very, very short. They're sort of 30 seconds long. They might be a minute at most. But it's just so impactful in the movie. And of course, without saying, the very famous shower scene we all remember. But yes. For me, it's sort of the opening credit music for me is just great. Mm. This sort of stabbing sort of forward momentum in the strings. It's just fabulous. Wonderful stuff. Now, of course, many film directors turn to classical music to sort of augment their soundtracks and sort of move beyond sort of original scoring. What do you think have been some of the most successful uses of existing music in movies?
I mean, certainly 2001. You know, Kubrick, obviously, he chose the music incredibly carefully. And, you know, you've got the Alzo Sprach Zarathustra at the beginning, you know, as the... And that music, I think, actually, more people think of the film when they hear that music than they think about what it was originally about.
Totally.
So, and then you've got that Ligeti at the end with this sort of weird psychedelic images of, you know, the strange planets as the main character. What's his name? Dave? He's called Dave, isn't he?
Yeah.
He goes through the wormhole. And that use of Ligeti... With those images, it's actually really spooky and scary. I remember showing it to a friend of ours when we were kids, because we used to watch it all the time, and she refused to watch it. She had to go home and call her mother, actually, because it was too disturbing. So, yeah.
Kubrick was a big fan of Ligeti.
Yeah.
He used it in other scores, I know Steve's about to mention, but we also used a bit of Ligeti in Eyes Wide Shut.
Yes.
And interesting, Steven Spielberg made a film called Artificial Intelligence in 2001, which was originally going to be made by Stanley Kubrick. And sort of in honour of that, John Williams inserted some Ligeti into his score as well, because he knew that that's what would have happened had it been made by Kubrick. Steve.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to add to the strong horror and unease vibe we've got going on today. And I'm picking the use of Bartok's music for strings, percussion and celesta in The Shining. I just think the atmosphere of menace, of creeping dread and of something unknowable. There's something in the walls. There's something terrifying, but it's as yet formless and unknown.
Such
and that music,
tips, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, exactly.
Great.
It just evokes that atmosphere of dread and unknowingness absolutely perfectly.
I think there's some Ligeti in that score as well.
Yeah. Gosh, there we go.
Can I be the dissenting voice here? He chooses
of course.
A bit of music which I think is really badly chosen for a film.
Oh, nice.
And almost had the effect of, it didn't ruin the film for me, but it kind of struck a certain discord, if I may. And that is the 1998 film, Elizabeth, starring Cate Blanchett in the star role. And throughout, most of the score was actually specifically written. It was a And it was actually based on music of the time. So there's sort of quasi Bird, sort of touches of Talis here and there. And it's actually, the score itself is superb. And it really brings you in, creates, again, it creates an atmosphere. But then right at the end, Elizabeth has a monologue. And as she's saying it, we hear Elgar's Enigma Variations, Nimrod.
Oh,
and we don't just hear Nimrod. We have Nimrod with a soprano line added on top. And it really jars, because you think, well, hold it there. This is kind of 1590 or whatever it is. And then we're hearing a piece from the kind of early 20th century. You think, why is that? Well, late 19th century, isn't it, the Enigma Variations? It kind of doesn't sound right. And you thought, after so much of the film had been so cleverly scored, and actually the score, the original score, won, or it was nominated for an Oscar. Yes. It was that good. Why did they put that in there?
Fascinating. It'd be fascinating to know. I mean, it could be a victim of the temp trek, which, of course, I discussed with Ben Dudley. So maybe the director or producers were like, oh, that worked really well there. Let's just keep it. Mm-hmm. But there may have been, of course, some other highfalutin idea that they had.
Just trying to strive for some slightly ineffable English or British grandeur.
I think it was, wasn't it? That sort of, here's the kind of great British moment in history or whatever. Yeah. But it just doesn't work. Mm.
Very strange, very strange. Well, I'm going to be similarly dissenting, actually, and I've changed my mind just at the last minute because it inspired me, Jeremy. So the film The Artist, which is a stunning black and white film, won a few Oscars. Mm-hmm. Brilliant original score until, like, almost, again, the end scene where he's staring at his own reflection in this sort of shopping street. They just cut and paste the Scène d'Amour from Vertigo by Bernard Herrmann. And it's literally that piece of music. It's not somebody imitating it. It is that piece of music from that film. So it's not a classical piece of music, but it's an existing piece of music in its own right from 1958.
That sounds like a temp track thing to
totally
me.
Totally a temp track moment, I think. Yes. And I don't understand really why. I still don't. And it stands out like a sore thumb. Mm. And it makes me cringe every time. Mm. But of course, there are other honourable mentions, of course, Apocalypse Now, Ride of the Valkyries, which I think, like the 2001s, inextricably linked now, and people will go, oh, that's Apocalypse Now, but actually, it's not. It's fun. We could go on and on with this, but thank you very, very much. We'll have the last word go to Anne Dudley, and this is the main title from her film score for Elle, which is a film directed by Paul Verhoeven.